podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
International Rap Special, and it's John Gibbons hosting, and we're delighted to be joined by Damien Hughes, who's an old friend now, I'd like to say, so welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me, John, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're here to talk about your latest book, which is The Barcelona Way. People who don't know Damien, who may be newer listeners, do try and listen to the podcast that we've done with him already. Maybe go back and do those first, because they are, you know, timeless, really. We've done stuff, a lot of stuff about leadership, and that's where your expertise is, isn't it, Damien? You're a professor, you're a motivational speaker, and kind of what you've done throughout your career, if you like, is speaking to leaders about creating winning cultures, and that might be in sport or it might be in business, yep. but anywhere that kind of wants to succeed.
Yeah, so that's my background. My background's I'm a professor of organisational psychology and change, so it's very much around how do you create high-performing cultures, and then how do you make them robust enough to cope with sort of change that whatever industry it is demands.
Yeah, and so this book itself is kind of subtitled Unlocking the DNA of a Winning Culture, and it's focused on Barcelona, and I think it's interesting that you sort of pick Barcelona as a case study, if you like, because what the book kind of reinforces, but a lot of us forget, is this Barcelona that we have now that we associate, it hasn't always been the case, has it? It hasn't always been the case. I mean, obviously, they've been a successful football club, but they haven't been the all-conquering kind of football club that we kind of know and associate them with now. And actually, when you start this book, they're in a bit of a funny situation, which kind of could have gone either way for them, really.
Yeah, very much. So the idea behind it was that my publisher asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book on organisational culture. Now, the reality is that's quite a dry topic on its own. So they said, would you be interested in doing it for your sports team? So we narrowed it down to three teams. One was the New Zealand Rugby Union team. One was the New England Patriots in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And then the third one was Barcelona. And the reason we narrowed it down to those three is a lot of teams talk about culture. A lot of sports teams will say, oh, yeah, we have a good culture here. But the reality is very few of them take it really seriously. And those three did. So we ruled out almost by omission. New Zealand had been done quite a lot. The New England Patriots, I don't know enough about it, so I felt that there'd be a little bit of fraudulence about trying to take an interest in something I don't understand. But Barcelona was the third one. So where the book starts is back in 2006, they'd won the Champions League for the second time in their history, so they beat Arsenal in Paris. And the club sat back almost, and by their own admission, there was a little bit of complacency. They just thought success was now going to continue rolling along. And the next 2 years, in the words of one of the board members that I interviewed, said it was like a slow-motion car crash taking place. So the year after they finished 18 points behind Real Madrid, the year after that, it got even worse. But it was by the March of the second season, when this was going wrong, they decided that they needed to do something very different. So they decided to replace Rijkaard, who was the coach at the time. But rather than panic, they let him go to the end of the season and use that period to properly investigate what culture could be and how it could be a competitive advantage. Because like a lot of clubs, like Liverpool, like Manchester United, like Chelsea or any other clubs in the Premier League, the reality is you get to a level where talent evens itself out, where the payroll is pretty much equal. And so you start looking at, well, what other competitive advantages can you have? And culture is one of these areas that is not that well understood and therefore offers you some brilliant opportunities. So Barcelona looked at, well, what could culture do for us? And what they found was that, first of all, there's five different types of culture. So that's interesting in its own right, because when you look at it, you see there's so many clubs will almost organically or by accident allow these five cultures to be created. Yeah. But what we know is there's one particular type of culture that is your equivalent of winning the lottery. And that was the one that is the more difficult one to pursue, but that was the one they went after. And the success over the last 11 years is unprecedented, not only in their history, but also in Spanish football history. So they've won 9 out of the last 11 domestic league titles that have been available to them. They've won the Champions League 3 times, having only ever won it twice before. In their 100-year history before this, they've been world club champions 3 times, having never won that at all. So you start to get an idea that culture, if you marry it up with talent, can actually be a huge advantage. And that's not just the case for football, it's the case for business or anyone running their own social team or in any context you like, if you understand it, it can be dynamite for you.
I just want to run those through those five different types of cultures, if that's okay, Damien, because I think people will find it interesting to kind of, because when you talk about them in business, but also identify a football team that it's most like. And I think that the top one, the first one, is the star model. This is kind of the what you described as the Real Madrid kind of Galacticos idea, which is go out and buy the best players you possibly can and hope they gel.
Yeah, and that's it. So so the star model is almost where you go out your way to recruit the best talent, pay them the highest money, give them the best facilities. Then you almost sit back and just expect that all that talent will come together and be greater than its parts. So Real Madrid offers you the best example of it. Since Perez came in 2003 with this Galactico policy, he's put it into place where you aim to recruit the world's best player year after year after year. Now, what the danger is for this is that we get blinded by the occasional success. So people can point that they've won the last three consecutive Champions Leagues, which has never been done in the modern era, and they go, well, it must work. But what you neglect to observe in that same period is they've only won two out of the last 15 domestic league titles available to them in that period as well. So it shows you how it's almost erratic. The best way to think about it is it's erratic, that when it works, it's spectacular, but when it goes wrong, it's also spectacular. So one Real Madrid coach described it as, he said, the problem with a culture like this is everyone wants to be the head waiter, but nobody wants to wash the dishes. So it's almost that idea that so the front of house looks great, but it's the back of house that'll let you down over a sustained period.
And the next one's autocracy, which is the idea of this one guy at the top. You mentioned Chelsea, Roman Abramovich. There's also business examples. I think things like Apple, where you've got Steve Jobs, who's the man, really.
Yeah, I think a more personal example since I wrote the book is Ferguson at United. Yeah. So I think that's a great example of it, that Ferguson had been developing a very different type of culture at the club until 2005, when the Americans came in and bought them out. And when that leverage buyout happened, Ferguson became the most powerful figure at the club. So the Americans have admitted themselves, if Ferguson would have publicly opposed them, they'd have never got the funding to do it.
Yeah.
And I think you can tell that the autocracy model at United started to take hold from them, because Ferguson's language makes some subtle additions. So one of his big phrases he used to say is, there's nobody bigger than Manchester United. Post-2005, he starts to add the caveat, there's nobody bigger than the manager of Manchester United. So I think what we've seen in the last 6 years since he retired is that vacuum that was created by his retirement has led to dysfunction, because you've got you have the occasional star model where they go and recruit the likes of Pogba and Sanchez for ridiculous money. You've got a bureaucratic culture, which we'll come on and talk about in a minute, where it's about rules and regulations. And then they've occasionally appointed an autocrat like Van Gaal or Mourinho, and what you've seen is those three cultures are almost fighting for supremacy, and the results on the field get almost become secondary to whoever's the dominant force.
The next one you've just quickly talked about there, but bureaucracy, and I think it's interesting in the book to use the example of kind of Liverpool under Brendan Rodgers, because that was a time that, looking back on, just did seem very confused. And I think that's something that can happen, is if you've got all these voices that are in theory kind of equal, then you end up kind of trying to please everyone and pleasing no one. And I remember the situation with Liverpool where it was the idea of, okay, well, if you sign one player, then this other fella gets another, and we end up the committee got Firmino, and then Brendan Rodgers got Christian Benteke, then suddenly you've got to work out how they're going to play together.
So it's almost like when decisions are made by committee, there's the old saying that a camel's a horse designed by a committee. So you're trying to appease everybody, and the reality is you appease nobody. And that was one of Rodgers' big complaints when he left, was that he said there's a confusion at the board level, because you've got that transfer committee where you've got Mike Gordon heading it up.
Mm.
And a lot of the example I offer in the book is the signing of Balotelli. So on statistics alone, he looked like a no-brainer, that you've got, I think it was Rodgers that said, you've got potentially a £70 million player that you've been offered for £15 million. So if you're just looking at it on stats, you go, well, why wouldn't we do it? But culturally, bringing in somebody like him that just didn't fit, that caused all kinds of trouble in terms of his, you know, like the stories you hear about his discipline or his timekeeping and things like that, was almost anathema to any culture that wants to be successful, but it made sense on a spreadsheet sat overseen by a committee.
Yeah, okay. The next one's engineering, which used the example of kind of Dortmund, really,
yeah.
Which is about a kind of specialist in certain positions.
Yeah, so you recruit people with a deep knowledge in a narrow domain. So again, like another topical example, so Dortmund are specialists in this, especially when Klopp was there. He was recruiting technically brilliant players and just adding them up. So he had this idea of his heavy metal football. I think a better example, if you look at it in the last decade, has been Arsenal under Wenger. So anyone that has been watching them can see that they've got some technically amazing footballers. Yeah. But they just don't seem to add up to be greater than the sum of its parts. So there's lots of technically exquisite players, but the cumulative effect of them in relation to a team isn't quite there. So, yeah, that's where... And what you find in engineering coaches, people make excuses for talent. Oh, he's a talented lad, but you should see what he can do in training. And they make lots of excuses for them because he's talented.
Yeah.
But the cohesion is often secondary in those cultures as well.
Okay, and then the last one, and by far the most successful that you found, not just studying sports teams, but also kind of businesses. And I think the actual original study was done in Silicon Valley, wasn't it, that found
that's
that
right.
Commitment culture was not the only one to succeed. And it's important we say that this isn't the, you know, that you will see successes in all those other cultures, but much more likely to concede if you can install a commitment culture, but it's also the most difficult.
Yeah, commitment cultures are almost your equivalent of winning the lottery. If you're prepared to pursue this, it's the most difficult one to get. But if you can do it, what the research from Silicon Valley said is commitment cultures tend to be about 22% more successful than the other four types of cultures. And as you point out, John, that doesn't mean that they're not successful. And like the Real Madrid example, they can burn really brightly. Mm. But the most sustained success is going to come from a commitment model. I mean, they find as well, there's another stat that says people stay loyal to commitment cultures even when they're offered pay rises of up to 36% to go somewhere else. So the best way to think about it is where doing good and being good somehow seem to overlap. And if you think about it, there's no coincidence that you go through, say, the last 50 or 60 years of football history, you'll find that commitment cultures are the ones that seem to dominate for periods. So you think of what Shankly set up when he came in from Huddersfield, this idea of that Liverpool were a representative of the city itself. You know, we had at the time we'd sort of like the links with the Merseybeat sound and the fact that his socialist principles, he spoke to the city. You look at what Ferguson did at United for that period where he came in and he had local lads playing and there was very much a sense of identity with Manchester as a city. And that's very much what Barcelona chose to do in 2008. This is the way that we're going to pursue it.
Yeah, it's that idea of selling a vision. You talk about that in the book, don't you? That a key part of starting a commitment culture is, okay, well, what is the vision? How are you going to set it yourself? And then how are you going to sell it to all the people you need to follow?
Yeah, so at Barcelona, they've got their own interest in history. So they've got the geopolitical context that they want to represent the best of Catalonia, the region, to both Spain and the wider world. And they see the football team as doing that. Now, the vision for them was laid down by Cruyff when he came initially in the 70s, because he diagnosed that they suffered from Madriditis. So his point, I really like this idea. He says you can't be successful if you view yourself as a victim. So if you see yourself as being subjugated by Franco's Spanish regime, you can't be successful. We need to come out there and identify what we stand for. So another way that he did it was he said, and we do this through playing with style and panache and flair. So his point was that it's not just about winning trophies, because he said if you do that by playing boring defensive football and you don't win the league, well, you've lost on both counts.
Yeah.
Whereas, so it's not either or, it's both and. We can be successful and we can do it by playing this stylish, exciting football.
So Barcelona said, we want to do a commitment culture. As you say, they spent a bit of time towards the end of that season deciding what they wanted to do. And then they employ Pep Guardiola, which I think can seem a no-brainer now because we know what a good manager Pep Guardiola is. But at the time, he'd had 1 year at Barcelona B, wasn't it? He'd obviously been a great player. But, I mean, Barcelona could have had the pick of any manager that he wants. And I assume if you'd done a poll of Barcelona fans at the time, Pep Guardiola would have been sort of quite low down the list.
Yeah, so they had a five-man shortlist. And Guardiola, if you looked at it, I mean, Mourinho was top of the list at the time because he was flying after his success at Chelsea and at Porto before that. Laurent Blanc was another one, and there was a number of other names. Guardiola was a 37-year-old novice. He was a former player that had been at the B team for 1 year, and he'd had a bit of success there. But on paper, you'd never consider him. But what they did was, they wanted someone to head it up. So the Daily Telegraph described a great line. They said, the guy that was making the decision was this guy called Ferran Soriano that's now at City. They said, he's the guy that sources the venue. The second guy they had was a guy called Cheeky Begiristain that's now at City as well, the director of football. They said, he's the guy that sources all the ingredients. And then what they needed was a head chef, which was where they decided on Guardiola. Now, their criteria to recruit Guardiola was really interesting. So if you view him just through a technical lens, he doesn't get the job because he's got no experience for a job that size. But what they did was they used a criteria that Warren Buffett, the American investor, advocates for any business or any organisation. You should view your leader through three lenses. The first lens is, do they have the energy to see the task through? The second criteria is, are they smart enough? Do they have the intelligence to know what to do? Now, his point is, if they have energy and intelligence alone, don't touch them. Because his point is, they could be really smart and energetic, but toxic to your culture. The third criteria is the deal breaker. And that is, do they have the integrity? Do they role model what they're going to ask the rest of the organisation to do? And in Guardiola's case, because they'd seen what he'd done as a player, that he was a more cerebral player. He made the best of his talents. But significantly, he role modelled the behaviours they were asking the organisation to do. And he demonstrated that. There was a track record of it. So what I mean by that is, we talk about in organisations, to have a culture says, well, how am I expected to behave? And they had three behaviours that were really significant.
Yeah.
The first one was humility. So they said, don't come into this organisation showing off your wealth, your privilege, your success, or your social media following, because that would indicate that you lack humility. And if you lack humility, that's an indicator that you lack the ability to listen to anyone else. And if you can't listen, you can't learn. And if you can't learn, you can't help us improve and get better. So humility was the first one. The second one was hard work. They say, if you come in here, you don't just coast on your talent. This isn't the end of the journey. This is just the end of the beginning bit. So you continue to work hard. And then the third one is, you put the team above your own self-interest. So the point they make there is, if there's ever a clash between what's right for you and what's right for the team, choose the team option.
Yeah.
Now, they were the three behaviours that they defined their success on previously at Barcelona, and they felt that Guardiola embodied all three of those that they'd seen as a player and what he was like as a bloke as well. So, because this was one of the questions I asked, I interviewed Begiristain, the guy I mentioned earlier. And one of the legitimate challenges to this is, yeah, but this is a club that's had Messi on its payroll. They've had Iniesta and Xavi and a whole heap of other supreme players. Is that why they've been successful?
Yeah.
And that's a legitimate challenge. And that was a challenge I put to Begiristain. And his point was, and it's a great quote on culture that sums up in any context. He says, your talent will get you as far as the dressing room door. How you behave decides if we'll keep you in there. So his point was, yeah, we do have talented players, but so do Real Madrid, so do Atletico Madrid, so do all our other European rivals. Mm-hmm. It's behaviour that will determine whether that talent can stay in that dressing room and be a member of a cohesive unit.
So Pep Guardiola turns up, he arrives. The first thing he does is say he's going to sell three of his best players and he hires a water polo coach. I mean, these are quite sort of extreme things to do on your first day, really. But I want you to sort of tell everyone a little bit more about both of those decisions, really, and why you did them and how it helped kind of install this culture from day one.
Yeah, so when he was offered the job, it was in the March time. So Cruyff was significant in this because they'd asked Cruyff whether he'd be interested in coming back almost like as a mentor to Guardiola. Because it was Cruyff who was championing him, saying, get this guy in, he'll be perfect for you, he's ready. And Cruyff refused. He said, no, just appoint him on his own merit, you don't need me here. And Guardiola describes it as the mariposa effecta. He talks about the butterfly effects of Cruyff set this whole thing in motion. So when they offered it, Guardiola was really interesting. He said to the board, he said, you wouldn't have the balls to appoint me. And they went, yes, we would. So he said, right, if you do then, I'm going to take over, but on three criteria. And the three criteria, or the main criteria was, you get rid of Deco, Ronaldinho and Samuel Eto'o. Because what had gone on in that 2 years previously was, those three guys had gone to war very publicly with each other. They'd never really got on, but they went to war. So they were doing sort of like briefings at press conferences where they were sniping at each other. Ronaldinho, after the 2006 World Cup, one of his entourage described it in quite a funny way to me. He said he decided to retire from football. He just didn't tell anyone. So so he pursued, like, by any measure, a pretty hedonistic playboy lifestyle. So there were stories of him coming to training direct from a club. But there were stories of, because he was such an engaging character, the masseur had let him sleep on the bench while they gave him a rub down, and they would find lots of excuses for him.
Yeah.
Now, what they noticed was that when this was taking place, Ronaldinho is obviously charismatic. He's had phenomenal success. He's well loved by the rest of the dressing room. What they noticed was a subtle effect started to take hold in their culture, where in that same 18-month period that he was getting away with these kind of unprofessional behaviours, 10 out of the 23 players in the first team squad separated or divorced from their partners in the same period. Now, it's no coincidence a number of them had been caught in compromising situations while they were out partying with Ronaldinho. What put the tin hat on it for them as a club, which was why they backed Guardiola on this, was that so Messi had come in the dressing room as a 16, 17-year-old adolescent boy, and he's seeing this, and unfortunately for him, Ronaldinho had befriended him and recognised his talent and sort of tried to nurture him and develop him. But twice by his 18th birthday, Messi had been in trouble for got caught drink driving coming back from parties at Ronaldinho's house. On one occasion, he crashed his car, and he was fortunate it was a Barcelona fan that he'd had a collision with who the club managed to bury it. But it was, the story is that it was Messi's dad had gone to the board and said, I'm not happy about the impact on the son that I've raised. And that was when they realised that if they didn't back Guardiola on this, not only would they compromise in the immediate success of the club, but they were also mortgaging the future success of it as well. So Guardiola come in and said, if I'm going to make a fresh start based on these three behaviours of humility, hard work and team first, get rid of those three, because they're my because they're the most influential characters within the dressing room, and yet they don't seem to embody those behaviours. So they backed him with that and gave him permission.
And he also did it quite publicly as well, I think, which is interesting in itself, is that it wasn't sort of, you know, it was his first press conference, wasn't it? I've got a sort of quote here from it, which says, individually, they are worth much less than when they invoke team values. And I think that's him. So he's setting out the kind of the division, if you like, isn't he? And he's showing authentic leadership, which is all things you talk about in there, which he's not just saying, I'm going to sell these three lads. He's saying, I'm going to come out and say why I'm doing it. Yeah. I reinforce what I expect from everyone who's going to play for Barcelona in the future.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is he changed his mind on Eto'o for a year. So although he came out and said, these three have got no part to play in it, he changed his mind. And what was interesting was that it was some of the other players in the dressing room said, Eto'o had come back after that summer break, and he was blitzing everyone in terms of his fitness and his statistics and his work ethic. So it was Puyol and Xavi and Iniesta that came back to Guardiola and went, you know those behaviours that you're holding us to account for? He is actually working harder than anyone else. He's keeping his head down and he's putting the team first, which was why he gave him a stay of execution and changed his mind on him. Now, Eto'o reverted to type later on in that season, which was why he didn't change his mind again and got rid of him at the end of that first year. But he was really clear about, these are the rules of the game that we're playing by these days. So everybody knew what it was that he was holding them to account for. There was no conversations about, oh, it's a personality clash or it doesn't fit. He was really clear about, these guys just don't evoke what I'm asking everybody else to do. And I think there's something quite powerful about doing that, because that way there's a transparency. We all know what we stand for here. We all know what you're going to judge us by.
Yeah, and it shows as well the kind of, I mean, you talk a lot in the book about arc of change, which is the period between deciding you're going to, you know, install a culture and kind of seeing it through to success, really. And you say something in the book which I found sort of very pertinent, which is, we all kind of, you know, if you tell the story of the Shankly era, it's all, well, Shankly came in, he set the vision out, and then he won lots of things. And what you kind of forget or what isn't told is the bumps along the way, the problems, yep. And the times where you have to kind of stay firm. And I think that's what Barcelona managed to do so well, is that in football generally, you know, fans, we just panic, don't we? And there's, you mentioned before about, you know, we make excuses for talent and we say just get him on the pitch, yeah, yeah, type thing. And Barcelona had some tough decisions to make, not just with those players, but when they signed Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and it was, well, how important is our culture to us, and you know, how far are we prepared to go to reinforce it?
Yeah, so it's an important point so if you look at the word commitment culture, so if you look at the word commitment as we're talking about in relation to culture, commitment implies a choice or a decision on your part. So you don't sleepwalk into a commitment culture. You don't find yourself there by accident. When somebody's saying to you, this is the way that we're going to judge you on, these are the behaviours that you expected, you have to make a really clear choice to either... And Barcelona talk about the FIFO effect. They say, fit in or fuck off. But don't pick and choose the bits you like. Don't say, I'll do that and not that bit, or I'll take that bit seriously, or on some days I'll sign up to it. Their point is, sign up to all of it or none of it. And once they'd set sail with this particular path, you're right that, like, the Ibrahimovic signing, and I decided to dedicate quite a significant chunk to that because of its significance culturally. So he was their record signing. They brought him in for €70 million, which was a record for them at the time, and then got rid of him for €45 million 10 months later. Now, on the surface, you go, oh, it must have been a personality clash, it must have been a conflict. But the reality was, Ibrahimovic came in and for his first 3 months was phenomenal. And then as soon as difficulties started to occur for him, he reverted to type. So they told him about, these are the three behaviours, he'd agreed to it. So when he first signed from Inter Milan, he said to him, are you sending a private jet to collect me? And he went, no, we don't do that. Humility is key here. We've got your seat on a plane, a commercial airline, get on that. When he turned up for training, they gave him the keys to his club Audi. He said, no, I don't need a car. He said, yeah, we know you've got a fleet of fancy sports cars. Don't drive them into training. And he agreed to all of this. And his first 3 months, when he was complying with it, he was phenomenal. Soon as he gets dropped for the first time, he turns up in a yellow Lamborghini. When he goes off on his Christmas break, he ends up doing what driving his snowmobile around in the mountains and all in Sweden. He knows he's not allowed to do it for insurance purposes. He gets himself injured. When they play Inter Milan in the European Cup, they ask him to help the team by playing in a different position, and he refuses to do so. So he transgresses the behaviours over his time there. And that was where the board themselves went, this is a really key moment for us as an organisation, because if we turn a blind eye to this, or we decide that we start making excuses, but he's a talented lad that we're paying a lot of money for him, we basically throw away everything that we've done in building this commitment culture. He's demonstrated he doesn't want to fit in.
Yeah.
So they made the decision to fuck him off, because you can't afford to compromise when it comes to this if you're serious about the message you send to the rest of the organisation.
I want to talk a little bit about cultural architects as well, because I think that's a really interesting element of the book, in that, you know, that Pep Guardiola is obviously the main guy who's setting out the vision, and he's the guy who's saying, this is the expectations. This is what I expect from all of you. But Pep can't be there all the time. Pep can't do it all on his own. And changing any culture or reinforcing any culture relies on what you describe as cultural architects, which is people basically in the dressing room who not just embody those values, but will also pull up others when they're not displayed.
100%. So we live in a weird world where we get caught up in this cult of leadership. So we assume that it's about Klopp, it's about Mourinho, it's about Guardiola, and we get caught, so they end up almost dominating the narrative. But there was a brilliant study done by Simon Cooper, covers it in his book Soconomics, but it was by a Dutch economist called Bas van der Veel that looked at how much impact does a coach have on the ultimate performance of a team. And what he advocates is they drive about 10% of the performance, and some of that is about this idea of setting the vision and behaving with authenticity. But the real power within a dressing room takes place from your peer group, the cultural architects. These are the leaders without title, the guys that run the dressing room that are there when nobody else is, that see what you're doing.
Mm.
Now, Guardiola was interesting because some of his first signings that he brought into the club was he promoted Pedro and Busquets from the B team where he'd been coaching the year before. And then some of his other signings were Mascherano that he signed from you guys.
Yeah.
And he brought Piqué in from Manchester. And one of the quotes that he gave to the Catalan press at the time was, those four guys have been recruited because they didn't have silly haircuts, sleeve tattoos or wear earrings. Now, you go, well, how's that in any way significant? So I was fortunate enough, I got to ask the question of Guardiola through his brother, who's his agent, who'd been involved in some of those deals. And his point was, he said, he's got no problem against any of those things. It's not a style issue, he said. But his point was, he was looking for something around the character of those guys. And what he wanted was people that weren't looking to stand out. They were looking to fit in. They were looking to assimilate into a group. They weren't looking to come in and shape it. So what he wanted was leaders in that dressing room, about four or five of people that really identified with those behaviours. Now, an easy way to do it is just get people to vote for it so the players recognise, against his criteria, who stands out. So he ended up with five guys that really identified with, this is the way we do things here. And then he gave them a really simple task. He said, catch people in. So when they're doing the behaviours, catch them in and recognise it. But when they're not, catch them out. And don't make a big fuss about it, but just gently guide them back in. So there's loads of examples of where, as a group, they started to demonstrate these behaviours. I mean, one of my favourite ones is they had a young lad called Thiago that ended up signing for Bayern Munich.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was 19, he made his debut for the club. He's come through La Masia, their academy, scores his debut goal, and it's the fifth goal in a 7-0 victory against Real Numancia. So it's not the most significant goal ever, but for him, it's like a crowning moment of a dream. And he runs across to the touchline and he starts doing this samba dance, and Dani Alves, the fullback, joins in with him and the pair of them do it. And if you look at the footage, there's people like Pedro that laugh along with it, that they're all delighted for the kid. But it's only when Piqué turns up and he stops the dance, he gives them both a clip round the ear. And in the press conference afterwards, he comes out and issues a statement in the press conference. And he says, I just want to apologise to the Real Numancia players. And he said, not for beating you 7-0, we wanted to beat you by more if we could, but I want to apologise for how we behaved after that fifth goal. He said, because we know you're honest professionals and we weren't looking to embarrass you or humiliate you, because humility is a key characteristic that we stand for. And he said, so I'm sorry if it came across in an arrogant way. I promise you it'll never happen again. So Guardiola, in the same press conference, came out and said, I agree with him. Because at that moment, you're looking at it going, wow, these guys really identify with, this is what we stand for. This is the kind of characteristics we want. And they were prepared to deal with it themselves rather than wait for the boss to spot it and take action.
And it's interesting to kind of focusing on these kind of individuals and what makes a football club tick. And it makes you think about, you know, football clubs that have been successful and maybe players who haven't seen the most fashionable, who managers have kind of kept around.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was the case under Ferguson. And you see, thinking about it from a Liverpool point of view, someone like James Milner, who you think Jürgen Klopp will always find the space for. And if Liverpool fans, you ask them to pick, what's Liverpool's best 11? They probably wouldn't put Milner in. They might put, you know, what they might do, but they might pick more sort of fashionable players or more kind of flamboyant players. You know, you probably see someone like Naby Keita pick more than you would James Milner by the supporters. But Jürgen Klopp always finds a way to get in there, and that kind of says something about how he sees him.
Yeah, so, I mean, United are a really good example, because watching it from a distance there, you can see the cultural vandalism that's taken place since Ferguson went. So I remember when Van Gaal came in and they were getting rid of the likes of Darren Fletcher or Johnny Evans and lads like that. Now, they're not your best players in the world, but they understood something around the culture of that club and the fact that they were allowed to go. Say United, where they got rid of Johnny Evans and they brought Marcus Rojo in from Argentina, and you go, well, what does he understand about the culture of the club? Like, he's not intending to stay in Manchester when he leaves. This is a guy that is not a significant upgrade on him, but culturally is a downgrade on what you're doing. And you're right about it in terms of when we've been on previously and we spoke about, is it Sacco?
Klopp had fired off quite quickly.
And there was a lot of, why has he done it? But this is a guy that obviously betrayed some of the values that Klopp was looking to instill at the club. And I think it's interesting what like, again, watching what he's done there, because he's obviously won a few of his battles at the board level to be able to have the right to make decisions like that, to get rid of him, and been proven that he's putting the culture of the club above self-interest or above just pandering to some of these stars. And I think you're right. I think Milner's a really good example of it, of a hard-working, industrious, decent, humble bloke that obviously embodies the kind of culture that that he wants. Van Dijk seems something similar to that, in terms of he's not, he, you know, it's not about him. He seems to evoke those team values. So I think Klopp's won the right to make some of these decisions now by the fact that he's not only judging them on talent, but how they fit within the culture as well.
I also had a bit of a think about Liverpool when you talk about the power of choice stuff. And there was a thing with Phil Coutinho where he was sold in January, and a lot of Liverpool fans were up in arms about the timing of the sale, and also the fact that we were selling a player on a long contract. And I think what Jürgen was saying, well, if he wants to go, then if he doesn't want to be here, then he should go. And look, Jürgen Klopp's not the first manager to have ever done that. You know, there've been other some very successful managers who've had that kind of similar idea. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's putting culture above short-term success. So obviously Liverpool would have been better off that February if Phil Coutinho would have stayed. Yeah. But would they've been better off a year down the line if you'd have said, you know you'd have sacrificed that commitment culture, and that also, you know, taking away that power of choice, you know, when you're trying to deal, you know, with players in the future.
Well, you spoke about that idea, John, of the arc of change, where so all change follows a pattern, and we know this except for when we're doing it. So we know that there will always be a period in the middle. It's often referred to as the messy middle, but the technical term is Cantor's law. Cantor's law is the bit when you're going through any change where it will look or feel like a failure in the middle. And what often happens is, and football clubs is a really good example, that's the period when we sack the manager. That's the period when we go, oh, get rid of the head guy, and you bring someone in to start the process again. They will meet the same challenges if you've not addressed them, and the whole process just keeps going on. Whereas when you sort of back them to get through that period, that's where you start to get the sustainable success at the other end. And I think you look at someone like Klopp, he's been pragmatic enough when he came in.
Yeah.
He was pragmatic enough to put short-term success in because he needs to get some credit in the bank. And then once he's achieved that, when he gets through that difficult period, the board are obviously now trusting him to go, this guy knows what he's doing. So even when we hit a difficult patch, we'll back him because we'll get through it. So if you don't win the league this year, you'll still be in contention next year. So it'd be the sense that he's building for the long term, not just the short term success. And I always felt that didn't ever look apparent under Rodgers.
Yeah.
It always looked like it was a bit of a fluke that year. There was lots of reasons when, you know, like the other...
It was a perfect storm type thing, yeah.
Yeah, other rivals, they had new managers in and things like that. You weren't in the Champions League. Suarez was flying. Sturridge was in form. So you had lots of things, but I wasn't convinced about the sustainability of it. What he's building at the moment looks something that will keep you in contention for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that's nice to kind of bring it back to Liverpool is this idea of big picture. And I think that's something that we talk a lot at the Anfield Wrap about, praising Liverpool, about saying, you know, it seems like much more of a one club mentality at the moment. It seems like the messaging that they're putting out is right. Yeah. And we all as supporters feel much closer to the football club and much more part of it than maybe we did 5, 10 years ago, when you just couldn't wait for something to criticise them for. And it does help that they're winning. And like Barcelona, it helps when you're winning. But also it's kind of much more than that, isn't it? It's about having this, you know, identity of a football club that people can get behind, and also clear messaging of what that is.
Yeah, so you look at lads like the fullback, the Scottish lad,
Andy Robertson,
that's come in for you. And something like him is again a bit emblematic of the likes of Milner as well. You know, like he seems like a decent lad that appreciates the success he's had, but he's not had it easy. He's had to come up through the hard way. So I was reading about Klopp over the Christmas holidays, and something of his own story. Do you know what I mean? He'd been a bit of a journeyman defender at Mainz, and then he'd almost found himself in the job by accident. And again, Klopp is recruiting guys that seem to be in the similar mould to him, that do value the power of team spirit to make up for your own maybe technical deficiencies. You know, and I saw the stuff where he was donating money to the homeless and the food banks and things like that. You're right. I think there's something really powerful about Liverpool represent the city, and there's something really quite fiercely proud about the region of Liverpool. Do you know what I mean? And I think these guys seem to be tapping into it, which, you're right, creates a huge amount of goodwill that you're prepared to forgive them the occasional lapses on the field, because you know that essentially the decent lads doing the best that they can.
Just a couple more before we finish. I realise we didn't do the water polo story, and people might be going, what was that about a water polo fella? Yeah. So we better tell them.
Yeah, so that's Manel Estiar. So this is Guardiola's right-hand man. He's a fascinating character. So he was regarded as the Maradona of water polo. So for years, he dominated the sport, and in Europe, it's a huge sport. So he was a superstar in his own right. And Guardiola and him were mates from Guardiola's playing days. And they became particularly close when Guardiola went out to Brescia to play for them. And then when he got caught up in the Nandrolone scandal, this Manel Estiar was a proper friend to him at that time. So they'd always stayed close. And Guardiola's first appointment when he came in was to bring Manel Estiar in as his right-hand man. I mean, he still works for him now at City. And this guy is just his eyes and ears. So one of the things that he gave him was, he said, I want you to just be clear about upholding these behaviours, the humility, hard work and team first. So there's lots of examples where he would just observe the players and then be feeding back to Guardiola. The famous story is where he used to sit on the substitutes bench and just watch who were the players that would be emotionally invested in the game and who were the ones that would sit chewing gum or chatting with each other. What SDR would look for that pattern over a significant period. And what he was looking for was, who are the ones that don't give a shit? Because they're not on the field, that they almost don't care what's going on. Because what that would indicate is they're not buying into the behaviour of putting the team first. They care when they're on the pitch. But if they're not, his point was, they're selfish. And you're getting evidence that you can present to the players to say, FIFO, fit into this, but start buying into it, or you can find your way out. And there was three names that were consistently transgressing this, and those, I mean, you don't have to look too far, but they were the ones that Guardiola just moved out within his first year. These were guys, and some of it was this Manel Estiar, just based on his observations.
What I wanted to finish on was this idea of sort of learning from Barcelona, but not making the mistake of copying them. I think that's something that comes out in the book as well. And I know you've spoken about it before. And I think that's... Well, football clubs, first of all, can make the mistake of being too short-term and make the mistake of kind of doing all the things you said, of just, oh, we'll just buy that player and it'll make everything all right, rather than kind of investing in culture of success. But also, I think a lot of us can make the mistake of, well, who's been successful and copy them. This was not the commitment culture necessarily, but the values and what they decided it was going to be impinned by was something specific that worked for Barcelona.
Yeah.
And another football club, you know, need to kind of pick their own, really, rather than kind of copy that. We see that a lot, don't we?
Yeah, so often. I mean, I find it really tiresome that a lot of clubs do it as a gimmick.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of clubs might focus on this in pre-season when they've got no matches, and they might dedicate a bit of time to it. And then the reality is, when they get into it, they forget it. And then when they're in a moment of crisis, they bring it back up and talk about it again. So, I'm lucky enough, I work in a couple of teams where my job is to take this seriously. And what's interesting is you see, like, other teams that we compete against, that when things go wrong, they immediately start talking about this topic. But you go, this isn't something you do every now and again. This is something you have to take seriously and come up with your own version of it. So I often encourage anyone that might be listening who says, well, how do I come up with my version of it? The way that I do it with teams that I work with is I use this philosophy called success leaves clues. And I say, when you're good, why are you good? Because if you can't tell me why you're good, when you're shit, how do you know how to fix it?
Yeah.
So the idea is, start with looking at, when you're successful, why are you successful? And get beyond attributing it just to, oh, we've got really good players. And say, no, what are the behaviours that are consistently present? So I'll give you an example. I work on the coaching staff at the moment with the Scotland Rugby Union guys.
You've been there a while, haven't you, now?
Yeah. So 2 years now. And we've done this with our own. So we took 12 months and said, there are moments where we are world class, but equally there are moments where we fall short of that. So what we've done is, rather than worry about why we fall short, look at when we're world class, what does that look like? And we've got three. So the three behaviours we have is, we do everything with high energy, we're brave, and we stick together, we're a team. So when we're good, you can see the evidence of those behaviours. When we're poor, the evidence is by their absence, if that makes sense. So what we're trying to do is get more of the good behaviours present more frequently. So it's the same for anyone that would be interested if they were applying it to their team at work or their kids' football team or in any context. Just start with that question of why, when we're good, why are we good? And then see how do we encourage more of those good behaviours and make them more frequent in our culture.
I could talk to you for hours, Damien, but I probably shouldn't take any more of your time. But
oh, loved it. Thanks for having
me. The book's out now. It's available on all platforms and all that. You can get it in physical form and everything, and yeah. Any kind of digitally, and I'm sure there's an audio book too.
Yeah, I did the audio books. When they asked me, I felt a bit like Andrew Sachs when he's Manuel in Fawlty Towers. trying to get my accent around some of the Spanish phrases, but there's an audio book out as well that might provide some amusement.
As I say, available. I've read it twice now because I read it a few months ago, and then I had to sort of do a bit of a recap for this. But really enjoyed it, and also enjoyed your time again so much, David.
Thanks for having me on. I'm really grateful. Thanks.
Cheers. Okay, thanks to David. Hope you've enjoyed that. Do let us know. And in the meantime, do buy the book and do enjoy it and have a look at your own cultures as well. Sports Social Podcast Network.